have a design company, and we design exhibitions and museums. We think of ourselves as being interior architects, really. But a while ago, we decided to move into the world of exhibitions, mainly because we thought the people in museums would be more interesting to work with than the people in the office management world. And of course, we were right about that. We've got two projects in this museum, actually. One is the British Galleries, which is in the corner of the museum, which we did opened 2001, and another slightly smaller one, the Portrait Miniatures Gallery, which is not so far from the theatre museum. But we've done quite a lot of work in the Science Museum on the other side of Exhibition Road. Anyway, that's just context. But I first became aware of Craig watching my father, Hugh Casson, who was working on theatre sets for Glyndebourne. Now, I had a bit of a struggle here because when I first realised this, I immediately assumed that it was the work he was doing for Alcest in the 50s. Then I worked out that I would have been 8. And then I thought, that is so disgustingly precocious to think that at the age of 8 I became aware of Gordon Craig. So then I began to think, well, maybe it was when he was working on subsequent project, which is L'Incoli Azione di Poppea for Glyndebourne. But anyway, I don't have to say a lot about this. I mean, I think the Craigianness of this is absolutely clear. But it's also the architecturalness of this. And essentially, my father was an architect. But I remember him, he used to draw at home in the middle of all the hurly-burly. And the more things that were going on, the better. You know, television, radio, children, piano practice. You know, that was when he was really happy to work. So we were all very aware of what he was doing. And really, I couldn't really spot a lot of difference between this as a theatre set and the work that he was doing for his architectural project. These images are all very familiar to you now. Tiny, just grabbed off the internet, I'm sorry, but here's one of my father's projects, the Elephant House in the Zoo. But you can see that really the connection is a very tight line. He liked the elephants, as he says they were his best clients because they never complained. So the point is that my father's theatre work was not revolutionary. It was unusual, I think. I mean, for Glyndebourne to have that sort of clean architectural set was quite unusual. Monochromatic and very dependent on lighting, and the colour all with the costumes, which would be draped around the singers. And a few very simple elements that would move gently to create different atmospheres. So the link here is obvious of one theatre designer affecting another, but Craig's influence and legacy it continues. And I regret now, of course, that I never discussed this with Dennis Laston, I'm sorry that these photographs are not very... I think maybe this is a slightly better one. But I cannot believe that Dennis didn't know about Craig's work and wouldn't have thought about him. And when Craig comes back into your consciousness as you walk around the city and you look at the work of other architects, this is David Chipperfield... Liebskind, who we know, thinks and talks about Craig. And there's Liebskind as a near miss at the V&A. And of course, Corbusier himself. So I wonder also what Craig would have thought if he had gone to New York. I think we gather that he never did go to America. Did he go to New York? Chicago? No, I mean, it would have been... He did. Didn't, no. Well, anyway, imagine Chicago and the work of Frank Lloyd Wright and Kahn and all these people. Anyway, and I think that the... I think it's already been mentioned that one of the things that fell into his lap, in a way, was the electric light as being a source of something that you could control. And sorry, a bit more Corb. And this little drawing, you have to forgive me, I'm not a scholar. I do my projects and I bumble into this world from time to time. So forgive me if my dates are squiffy and all the rest of it. I'm just making sort of the visual connections which occurred to me. But one thing that occurred to me seeing this little sketch, which is about light, and specifically about Italian light. There was a photograph we saw this morning of him working on the model in Florence with sort of curtains or some kind of dust sheet over the models and this amazing Italian light. And you wonder what would have happened if he'd emigrated to Finland or somewhere, or whether his work would have been actually a little bit different, or even Russia, you know. My memory of Michael's Holroyd's book was him mentioning Craig going to the National Gallery, and this is my fantasy, so again, this is me sort of being a bit wicked, but there is something about the 15th century Italian painters where I think there's a sort of interesting parallel here with concern. There's something about the way that cities are depicted and the way of, here you have these towering structures with these small figures. Also the multiplicity of the overlaying of more than the depicting of the same figure, the narrative being overlaid into one image, which I think is quite interesting and leads something on about marionettes and things, I think. But perhaps I love this one of the child falling out of the window and him being rescued and then he's back on his feet again, all in one split second. It's absolutely beautiful. And also that when he went to Siena, he would have seen the great Lorenzetti frescoes. But the other thing that really interests me about these painters is the idea of the removing of the fourth wall, so that you can see into the rooms and you're aware of activities that are going on in private. And... this is a wonderful example of, you know, all these wonderful births of the Virgin, which are all happening in these rooms, but actually you're essentially outside because the city's around you. Anyway, I'm just speculating, but I think there's a sort of really interesting story there, which I would love someone to pay me to do. But what I wanted to really tell you about was an adventure that we had when we were visited in our office by a young Russian. I keep thinking of him as a young Turk, but he's not a young Turk, he was a Russian, but he was a sort of young entrepreneur, developer. And he just bought this building in Moscow. This is actually after it's been cleaned up. And when we saw it, it was a little bit more like this. And he wanted us to help him because he had... He wanted to turn this great thing into offices. It was one of 13 buildings on this campus, and he wanted to turn it into offices. And these redundant factory buildings used to manufacture gold and silver thread. And in the 19th century, when they were in full flood, they were doing terribly well, as you can imagine, because they could supply the court and the navy and the army. And the church, all of which consume vast quantities of gold and silver thread. So the family, the Alexeyev family who owned it, were doing terribly well. And the The member of the family who was running it was assassinated in true Russian tradition. He happened to be mayor of Moscow at the time. So the other son of the family had to take this on. The other son of the family, of course, was this young maniac, theatre passionate young Konstantin, who had got caught with his amateur theatricals and had upset the family because the family didn't like their name being splashed around in amateur theatricals. And he was told to take on a new name, so he took on the name of Stanislavski. So that was his, became his stage name, and Alexeyev was his working name when he was running the factory. And he started this sort of double life. And our Russian client, having got this building, he wanted something in the entrance to this building, which would be about Stanislavski. And he knew that it couldn't be a museum. It wasn't about objects and things. And he wanted it still to operate as a lobby. So he coined this phrase, the museo lobby. I've noticed that foreigners are very good at coining really useful words for us. We're not so good ourselves, but they seem to see it more clearly. So the museo lobby became our project for about 3 years, I suppose. And he funded us and a team of other people, including Kate, to do 2 years of research, much of which was new, rootling around in archives in Moscow and here and other places, and digging up stuff that nobody had seen before, and it was wonderful. Our problem was how we were to make this into some kind of experience for this lobby space, this museo lobby. And it was tricky because we knew that our audience were not voluntary exhibition visitors. Most people go to exhibitions go because they want to see what they've come to see, but people coming to this place were coming to meetings. So this is a plan of our space, what's quite interesting in a way is that people were to come in here and go through this weather lobby, which is where they shook off all the snow and so on, came in here, went to reception desk, and then would go through to the back where there was a bank of lifts taking them to the upper floors. We suggested that we had our space here for our exhibition, whatever it was going to be, and that this was going to be the place where everyone sit around having coffee in their meetings. But because of security, they now have barriers here and here. We put up these very large screens, some of which were extremely large. And these screens were made of a kind of goldish mesh. And it was a fairly obvious reference to these screens and a fairly obvious reference back to the gold thread that had been made in the factories. And the other thing that we did is that we persuaded this guy These were the floors, this is a section through the building, so these were all going to be offices, all charging thousands of rubles a minute to the tenants. And that was going to be his office on this level. And so here is the entrance, here, that level, and there was going to be a sort of mezzanine level with balconies overlooking this. We persuaded him to put in a fly tower here, which essentially meant that he lost a great chunk of real estate in his office space and made the profile of his office space upstairs really very hard. We designed that too, so we had to take responsibility for making it look perfectly ordinary and logical. But, I mean, actually, it was an extraordinary gesture. So we carved out this thing because our idea was that these people coming to the lobby who unfortunately no longer understood really or felt about theatre in the way that Russians used to. For Russians, theatre was a wonderful route to communication at a time when things are very difficult, and we all know that they feel passionately about theatre. But this generation, this younger generation, he felt didn't have that same level of commitment and didn't understand what theatre was about. So the key for us was this thing of, wouldn't it be interesting if the installation that they saw when they came in on Monday was different from the installation that they saw when they came in on Tuesday, and different from what they saw on Wednesday, because the key thing about theatre is that it's never, ever the same thing twice. And even if we all know, you go to the same play night after night after night, it's never the same. And so this, he bought into this, and the idea was that this fly tower would hold the exhibition, and that there would be a programme which would allow all the elements of the exhibition to come down. And I can say electrify everybody. I don't really mean that literally, but I mean it would. What was interesting about this is that most exhibitions that we do, I mean the British Galleries would be an example, is essentially they're there, and essentially they're pretty much the same when you go back and visit them again. Of course they change because the people in them change them, and the interaction of the other visitors changes the atmosphere. But essentially, it's the same thing, and we don't have the same phenomenon in theatre, as I just said. But they're both time-based activities. In the theatre, it's a slightly more passive activity. You are there watching what the director wants you to see, but there is this rogue element of these dynamics which we can't put our finger on, and the actors and so on. So you could say that film is the most passive of all, where you're just sitting there just sort of doing whatever the director wants you to do, the off cry or whatever. And then with an exhibition, you're more in control. You can choose, like you've just been up to Kate's installation, you choose what you look at, how long you stay in front of each picture, how long you play with the interactive. And in a sense, it's a more active thing to do, with or without interactives, which are the sort of extra layer that gets put in. So we were quite intrigued about this, and we're trying to find, I suppose, a new overlap of how these two things, this notion of theatre and this notion of exhibition, might overlap. So here are the screens. Perhaps I should have showed this to you a bit earlier. But the very sort of first ideas about what this thing might be. And as I said to you before, we had no content. I mean, we had no objects. It was all going to be through images, films, interviews, text, and so on, although minimal text. So this was a very, very early sketch idea of what this thing might be, with these big panels flying down and up. Oops, sorry. Up in the I'm pressing the wrong thing. That's right. Up in the gods here. These not in the gods, in the fly tower. These pieces of furniture which would come down and change the dynamic floor level. And this was an early animation that was done to suggest what might happen. And these were all bits of furniture that you could approach. This was a travelling trunk from Moscow Art Theatre, but it had video and it would have a little theatre inside it. And these were suitcases that you could open and close and la 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 la. And it was all much too complicated and expensive. And I think as all designers here would know that quite often when I hope clients aren't here, but fellow designers who are here, that when clients say actually it's all too expensive and I want to cut it by a third, actually it's usually quite a good thing. You can whine at the time, but actually I think this thing of containing and holding back and pushing and pushing is always a good thing. So here is the fly tower constructed, and this little window here was his, that's the way into his office. He went up the lifts and along this passage at the top, and this window gave him an opportunity to look down into the lobby and see what was going on, how people were reacting. I think the next thing that happened was that we invited someone else to join our team, who's a young theatre director who was working in Canada, called Nick Hutchinson, who's come out of another dynasty, theatre dynasty, because his Peggy Ashcroft was his mother. And I wanted him to see, I want to see if having a theatre director as part of our exhibition team would sort of unlock this thing. And his idea was that how it would be interesting to take Hamlet as a structure, but to use the Seven Ages of Man as the architecture of the exhibition, so that each installation that came down from the fly tower would be an examination of the Seven Ages of Man, and these Seven Ages of Man would be Stanislavski's story. And because it was Hamlet and the relationship of Craig and Stanislavski and so on, how interesting that would be. And so we struggled with that for a little while, and that didn't help. That was also rather complicated. Sorry, these images are a little bit out of sequence. Anyway, this is the lobby as it is at the moment, taken on my auto-stitch app on my iPhone, which creates these rather weird images, but actually in some ways makes it clearer what's going on than some of the more regular photographs here. Here you can see the screens here that have light scudding down them. That's the reception desk with these very austere young Russian girls sitting behind. And in the end, what we did was that we explored this idea of just having a white box, which is this upper thing. It's a white box sitting in a black box, and that we would put projections onto that. But this was all about, we went back to this thing of Stanislavski having these two lives, the Alexeyev life and the Stanislavski life. So as Alexeyev, he was conservative, he was cautious. The factory was run very carefully. He didn't really like spending money, but he wanted to look after his workers and la 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 la. Then he would go to the Moscow Art Theatre, and of course all hell would break loose. He'd spend money like water. He would rehearse for years and years and years and say the night before, this is no good, we've got to start again, and drove everybody crazy. And these two sides to his character were really extraordinarily different. And then it suggested to us, therefore, that the outside of this box, we could explore these the sort of public Stanislavski. And the inside of the box, we would be exploring the inside Stanislavski. So this animation that's just been shown here is the story of his family travelling to Munich on a train. The inside of the box is the more domestic perspective. His portrait there, the views in through windows, the views out through windows. So here they are arriving at Munich. The train goes off. He and his family are left on the platform. And they get arrested because this is the outbreak of war, and they're in prison for a few days and so on. So it was that sort of way that we were proposing to tell these stories. And this little group of images here, they were all going to be separate little screens with interviews. They were going to be the Greek chorus, if you like. They were going to be contemporary directors and so on talking about commenting on what was going on and why Stanislavski still had relevance and so on and so forth. This was more, this is an exploration inside the box where this is Stanislavski at home. There's the Greek chorus. There's Liliana. The table would be set out, and time passing might be explored through food. This is the window from the outside world looking in, and he starts off his life with all the accoutrements of 19th century table, cutlery and glass and silver, and of course as he gets older. And this is his dream dinner party. This is Newton talking to him about his work. And his dream dinner party would be the people who he had been deeply influenced by. So Newton was one of them. Getting my tools muddled up. Oh, well, so anyway, it never happened. So the lobby's there, the fly tower's there, and then there was a crash, and so it all went on hold, and, you know, we fantasize about it happening, and it may or may not. But the other quite nice thing is this same young Russian. This is another view of the back of the factory, and this is the theater he built, Stanislavski built, for his workers, and the marketing director was the theater director. And Sergei has restored it, and now it's working as the Arts Theatre with his theatre company in it, doing wonderful work, actually. So another... this is my own sort of personal story, of course. This is why I've called it Craig sitting on my shoulder. There's another sort of curious link, which is that Godwin... well, this is one of our prize objects in the British Galleries, so... it's another way that Craig sort of slipped into my life. And I don't know where the V&A got this one, but I wondered if it might have been Ellen Terry's, because she certainly had one. The other thing is that Nick Hutchinson, who I mentioned earlier, his family, because Komisarzewski Junior came to London and married his mother, and his own sort of journey through the theatre has been with all these big names. So he and I are plotting a sort of performance exhibition which might start in Moscow and go to Paris and then go to London and Canada, which is something about an exhibition with performance in it with four players and some of this work, some of these projections and so on, which I think could be very nice. And this is a little postscript, really. So here's the great sketch of Hamlet with the court all under one huge, wonderful sheet of gold cloth. And a little while ago, my company was asked to work, because we do work other than exhibitions, and we were asked to work in a school in Ramsgate, and develop a place where girls who are being bullied in the playground might go as a sort of place of sanctuary. And we have somebody in our office called Craig, and he did this really nice idea, which is that you have a great big balloon, and all the girls could put their heads through holes in this cloth, and they'd all be talking to each other inside and telling each other all their private thoughts. Little light bulbs inside. And I thought there was a wonderful overlap there with this Hamlet image of the court under one cloth. So that's it.